Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS, Roy. I am the net control operator for this, the Limewark Technical Net. As always, I like to tell people some facts. If you have any questions or topics, or if you want to have me tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to review or take a look at a video or a website, and you can't get onto the net proper, you can email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. There is a link page with link items based upon material that's covered on each week's technical net. We have a little puzzle up there, so if anyone is inclined, it's not that difficult. It's a little bit of a math problem, but I'm sure you can figure it out. And that's at roy.ac2gs.com. You just point your browser at roy.ac2gs.com, and you'll get the link page with the puzzle. We maintain a chat room. You can get to it by either getting through the Limewark website, or you can just directly type into your browser, chat.2gs.com, and that'll bring you to our chat room. And as I always try to, I am streaming this on the Internet, so if you have any people that you know that can't pick up the radio transmission, they don't have Echolink, they don't have IRLP, just tell them to point their browser at technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give them an audio stream. And as always, I like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive of past technical nets going as far back as 2006 in September. You can find that at amateurradio.tv. So let me drop for a sec. Tonight, unfortunately, Andy is busy with other things, so there will not be a Andy's Corner. So we will take questions from the audience and topics and discuss things as best we can, and maybe if there's time, go through a puzzle or two. And then at approximately 10:15, Paul will be here with the SpaceNet report. So I shall open the TechNet to all of you guys and ladies out there. If you have any questions or topics or comments for tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
K2TGW,
yes. W2BZ, Rich.
Les and Rich recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight? It's, you know, we're going to have a lot of time for questions, so I hope there'll be a few more questions. But anyone else want to be on the list, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, perhaps later. Les, K2TGW, what's your question, comment, or topic tonight?
Okay, got a new rig. Matter of fact, I'm talking to you on it now. It's an Anytone D578UV3I. I don't know what all that stuff means, but that's what it is. It is a DMR and analog dual-band transceiver. Got it programmed, built a word plug, a code plug, pardon me, but I have a question. When you go to a zone, so you pick a repeater to deal with, whether it be one of the Limewark ones, Glen Oaks or Plainview, I can't get to the one in Suffolk County, it's unimportant, N2ION, there's one in East Meadow, there's several in Brooklyn. Are any of them better than others as far as being better connections to either Brandmeister or DMR Mark? Over to you, George.
Yeah, Les, the name's Roy, but unfortunately the answer is a combination. Yes, some repeaters give you much more access to when it goes through the repeaters, it's not really Brandmeister so much as it's called a C-Bridge, which was the original network that that the DMRs, amateur DMR, used to access. And unfortunately, each repeater has decided on a series of talk groups that you have access to and those that you don't have access to. And they almost always don't publish it too many places. So you either have to do detective work or find out who the repeater control operator is and ask him what talk groups are allowed. I mean, you could try hit or miss. You could go on that repeater, try and trigger a talk group that you're interested in and see if it goes through. Originally, I think most of the talk groups were tended to be allowed, but as hotspots became bigger and bigger things, and repeater control operators did not want their repeaters to wander all over the place, they narrowed the field of talk groups that can be linked. So that's the short version, but if you have any further questions along that line, please feel free.
Sorry about the name, just a mix-up. No, I was just wondering, because most of them all have the basic ones, but some seem to do better at others than, and I couldn't understand whether it was me or, but then my third thought was each one favored other things. And you're right, some or many do not publish what it is, and it's hit and miss. Okay. You answered my question, and you sort of reinforced what I already thought. But it's interesting, and I wrote a code plug, and I couldn't hear anybody. I did get a tech from Anytone who spent most of an hour and a half, the first hour, trying to figure out what I did wrong, and he gave up on that. But I did know of a known code plug, but it was written in RTS, not CVS, and I had tried converting it, and it didn't work. I told him where everything was on my computer. I let him in because you gave him a computer to use it. There was nothing secretive in. And he did what I did, but he had more patience. Sometimes patience is a virtue, Roy. K2CGW.
I think patience is almost always a virtue. Yes, code plugs are very problematic, and I've had this discussion with many people. Almost no one, when they first get a DMR radio, writes their own code plug out of nothingness. Almost everyone that I'm aware of asks friends, and eventually someone hooks you up with something that's reasonable for your geographic location, because you don't want a code plug from some guy living in Southern California. It doesn't really help you much. So there's always groups of people who share code plugs. I know Limark used to have a Yahoo group. I think we now have an IO group, and I'm sure there's some degree of sharing code plugs. The CSV is a comma-separated variable. It's the most generic way of arranging a code plug. Usually, the code plug software is saved as these RTD or RTA. You know, there's a few different types of forms that they form into. So I'm sort of surprised that you couldn't find a whole bunch of people, because the 578 isn't esoteric. It's been out, I think, for about a year. A lot of people have 787s and 767s. I lose track of any tones. They're not identical, but you can massage them into working for a 578. So I'm glad you got it to work. It's a bit of a jump in metaphors. Amateur radio operators really don't have things that compare to zones. Zones are just collections of channels. So it's a hierarchy that hams don't usually deal with.
I would agree, but my problem was I knew I found the conversion program, but when he did it, it lasted a minute or two, and I was also on the phone at the same time. He said, no, you have to wait, and it took close to 5 minutes for the conversion, but I didn't have the patience for that 3 or 4 days prior to that. that was the difference. I don't know if I would have done it exactly the way he did it, but came out with a lot more programming than I wanted. But it seemed funny because the guy who wrote it, he wrote it for Long Island, but he lives in Rome, New York. But it was basically very similar than the Limark one that I have on my TYT-380. A lot of stuff is the same. But I was just wondering if I needed a different zone. So I guess I can fool around with picking up more zones and finding out what I can get away with each of those if they don't want to publish it. And I guess many of them don't want to. But thanks for your help, a little insight, and save me from tearing out any more hair out of my head. Not much left there, Roy.
Bravo, Zulu.
Yes, Rich recognized. 1 minute. We're all kind of getting rid of some of our hair, and it's growing in other places as well. It's weird getting older. But, yeah, I could certainly understand it. It's problematic. I don't know why. I think it's simply because no one bothered to organize a central directory of repeaters versus what talk groups are acceptable. You'd think that eventually some clever guy would sort of do that, especially with just DMR repeaters, because it would be a very useful resource. But it doesn't seem to exist. So I'm not quite sure why, but that's just the nature of DMR. It's one of the speed bumps you have to deal with, especially over time, because as I mentioned, I think originally they were much more open with the talk groups, but because hotspots became popular and a lot of people will just go directly to hotspots, the people running repeaters wanted to narrow their scope to talk groups that they thought were worthy of being repeated on their repeater. Rich, you wanted to say something on the subject.
I'm MKD203B.
W2BZ. I did. Zones are probably, in the end, one of the least needed features of DMR. Because you could have, let's say, a zone for all repeaters in Queens, and one for all repeaters in Brooklyn, and so on and so forth. Or you can have one zone for all of those repeaters in the five boroughs. Or you can have one zone for all repeaters on Long Island. It really doesn't matter that much, zones. There's a lot more to deal with than zones, which are just like cabinets in a bookshelf where you just group different repeaters. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the problem is that when Motorola thought this up, they set up this hierarchy. So if you do not set up zones, you have no way to access the frequencies, the repeaters, the channels, however you want to, metaphor you want to use. So in order to gain access to the channels that ultimately everyone wants to, you have to arrange them in some form of zones, and the limitations of the number of zones is dependent upon the hardware, not really any kind of protocol. So you'll have radios that are capable of only eight entries per zone, others 16 entries per zone, and so you kind of are limited by the hardware programming limitation firmware of the radio you're dealing with. But you have to keep in the metaphor, because if you go outside of the metaphor, then the Motorola system kind of fails you.
You know, you need a zone to operate the radio. The radio is not going to work without a zone, but you could have one zone comprised of 16 repeaters, you know, two zones comprised of 32 repeaters. I mean, how many repeaters are you going to have? Usually you won't have to go beyond, you know, one or two zones. So that's why I say there are other things that are much more troublesome and bothersome and hard to figure out than our zones, is all I'm saying. In other words, not for a newcomer, a newbie, which I'm half and half now, not to put too much emphasis on zones as opposed to channels and talk groups and other stuff like that. Go ahead.
Okay, but I mean that puts another little wrinkle on why DMR isn't quite the same as analog repeaters. With analog repeaters, all that you're really going to give your radio is a frequency, an offset, a PL tone, and that's pretty much it. With a DMR, you also sometimes want to give it a talk group. So you can have a channel for the, you can have 16 channels in a zone for the same exact repeater. The only difference is each one of those channels is set to transmit packets on a different talk group within that repeater. So again, it adds a level of complexity that doesn't really have an equal, as far as I can think of, for FM analog repeaters.
Somebody else was in there that wanted a comment.
Probably me, KD2OGB.
Okay, Craig, please, what's your comment?
Also, want to get thrown on the list. I've had only one issue with CodePlug. There was a time where I was using my DMR, even though I haven't even... There was once a time where as soon as I hit the word write, the computer just blue-screened on me and then just rebooted. What's up with that?
I'm not exactly sure what you're relating. You typed in the word write. I'm assuming you're talking about a CPS software that's used for programming code plugs?
Nah, I was putting in frequencies and then... Ah, phone's going off. I was putting in frequencies into the DMR radio, like doing all of that, and then as soon as I clicked the word write, it just froze and crashed on me.
Okay, so let me figure this out. What you did was you programmed the CPS software on your computer. When you then went to the stage where you're writing the information to the radio, it froze up and died. There's a bunch of different possible reasons. Are you sure that you set the CPS software to look at the correct COM port? Because it doesn't really, it's not really terribly smart. So it might choose the wrong COM port and try to write something into a COM port that can't tolerate that and can blow up your operating system. That's a possibility.
Yeah, pretty much, but that was the only issue that I had with it. But it only crashed like maybe once or twice, but the last time I ever did it, which was probably a year ago or something, it hadn't done it on me ever since.
Okay, that's good that it hasn't happened again. One of the things with CPS, it's a very, in my sensibilities, it's a very primitive piece of software. It looks like it originated out of some Visual Basic source way too long ago, and it's been jury-rigged and modified for different Chinese DMR-type computers, because they all sort of look alike, although the formats are saved a little bit differently. The appearance seems almost identical. And I always find it sluggish. It makes no difference how many cores you have, how much memory you have, you know, how fast your machine generally is. CPS runs very, very slow and very painfully at times. And I could sort of understand that when it's uploading and downloading, especially contact lists, if you download all the contact lists available for DMR, that's a lot of data that has to run on the COM port. But even to manipulate data on the screen, it seems tediously slow. But one of the many things wrong with it is it's not smart enough to detect what COM port you've plugged in your radio. So you pretty much have to remember to set that setting in the software before you hit the send button.
Could be. And plus, this was on an old computer. This probably wouldn't do it on a newer computer. So that's all I have for now. KD2OGB.
Okay, very good. I guess we took on the topic less, and I wish you luck, and I hope you enjoy the 578. It looks like a very nice mobile radio. I have a an 878 myself. I have a Kinect Systems 800, they're okay. I hope you enjoy your 578.
So far, it's been fun. It's been easy once I got past the code plug part.
Yeah, code plugs are the big speed bump with DMR. The other more amateur radio-centric digital voice technologies like Fusion and D-Star were kind of designed from the bottom up for amateur radio operators. So there's less of the odd metaphors like zones, and instead of unique seven-digit numbers identifying you, they accept call signs and such, which makes life much easier, and you don't have to go and look up reference lists and such. So that's one of the problems with DMR in general, but I wish you luck and hope you enjoy your 578. On to Rich, W2BZ. What's your question or comment or topic for tonight?
Okay, my question is this, which seems like a very simplistic one, and it probably is. I'm using a ground plane that's about 6 feet, and the radials are, let's say, I didn't measure them, 18 inches. There were three of them pointing down at, I guess, 45-degree angle, and they're about 6 feet off of the ground. What physically is happening is interacting with those radials to make the antenna work the way it does, or work better, or work at all. In other words, physically, what is the circuit? What is the need for those radials pointing down at 45 degrees? Go ahead.
Okay. AC2GS, by the way. We go on to antenna theory, which is interesting and not incredibly simple, but I think enjoyable. The prototypical antenna in free space, we often say, is the half-wave dipole with a center tap. So one quarter of a wavelength on one side, one quarter of a wavelength on the other side, and the feed point in the middle. In free space, it has a nominal impedance of about 73 ohms. But you can play games with that design. If you remove one leg of that dipole, you have a problem. It's sort of like being on a seesaw with one of the halves of the seesaw sawed off. So you sit there and nothing much happens. You can't go up in the air because there's no one on the other side. So what you do is you basically put an infinite mirror where the other dipole leg started, and the reflection of the first dipole gives you an imaginary second dipole and a balance, and you get a radiating antenna. But unfortunately, it's very expensive to have an infinite plane of conducting material. Let me drop for a second. So you take a look at what physics lets you do and what physics doesn't let you do, and you don't need an infinite amount of metal as a mirror. You can fake it with a very small amount of metal, about one-third of a wavelength at a right angle will give you a degree of that effect of mirroring. Unfortunately, if you just use one of those, you lose the general radiating pattern. It becomes localized to where you put that one radio. So, in order to have a nice surrounding signal, you have three radials. You put one and another at 160. You have three. Three is about the minimum ground planes that you can put in order to have a nice generalized radiating pattern for a quarter wave monopole. But since you cut that dipole that had 73 ohms in half, that monopole only really has 36 ohms of impedance, and you really would like it to have 50. So how you increase the impedance at that point is by bending those radials off angle at approximately 45 degrees. So when you take the radials and twist them down 45 degrees, you get approximately a 50 ohm impedance quarter wave vertical with ground plane. And that's basically what turns a dipole into a vertical ground plane.
Okay, but in relationship, you bend those radials down and they react in relationship to what? Or they react with what? Go ahead.
They react with the quarter wave vertical radiator. They're part of the radiation system. And so it's not a balanced system because dipoles are balanced. Verticals are not balanced. They're unbalanced radiators. But they interact with the radiating quarter wave and change the impedance of the two of the signal being fed to the quarter wave radiator and to the radial arms at the base.
So are you saying it sort of reduces the impedance? It reduces the impedance of the radiating vertical. Is that what's happening? And if it is what is happening is reducing the impedance, how, I guess, in physics, is it doing that?
Comment.
Yes, please, comment.
W2HL, good evening, Rich. Good evening, Roy. Aren't the radials act as a quarter wave to the other, to the vertical, which is the other quarter wave? So in other words, with the radials, you then have a half wave. Is that correct? Or that's my question. And if you, I know some stations have a lot of, they add a lot of radials. They have like more than 10, even up to, I've heard 40 or 50. What does that do? Does that just, on the ground, does that just increase the pattern or make the pattern more omnidirectional? Back to you, Roy.
Well, it doesn't act exactly as though it's another quarter wave radiator because they're very seldom anything close to a quarter wave. So they serve the same sort of purpose. They're the other half of the radiator. They're the other end of the seesaw, if you will. But instead of it being a single piece of wire, it's split into more than one. Again, if you take a radial, just a vertical quarter wave, and you have one radial, you'll get a signal that tends to go towards that radial. If you want a omnidirectional, you have to at least have three. The reason why some people have a lot more than three is dependent upon where you're actually going to put the vertical. If you put the vertical in free space or far enough away from the surface, the ground, you only need those three radials to be omnidirectional. As you place the vertical closer and closer to the ground, you get ground coupling, which causes some of the energy to be tapped by the earth ground and dissipated in warming worms and other creatures underground. So your efficiency drops. So if you're going to mount a vertical ground plane close to the ground, you should put a lot more wires around it, 36, 40 I've seen, radials, in order to shield it from ground losses. So that's why some verticals have a lot more radials than others. With UHF and VHF, that's usually not placed directly on the ground because elevation is all, you don't have to worry about ground losses. So you don't have to worry about anything more than three little radials, just to give it a nice omnidirectional transmission.
Follow-up question. The wavelength of the vertical itself, is that, since the radials do not make up the other quarter wave, I'm assuming that we're talking about a vertical that is a half wavelength in length, depending upon its frequency. Is that correct?
No, because that's a different thing. If you had a length of wire, a vertical, that's a full half wave, then theoretically you no longer need to have a radial. You need to have a ground, but that's where the end-fed wires kind of come into existence. Because not at best, they should be half wave. So what you really have is that same half-wave dipole, except instead of the feed point being in the middle, where the impedance is approximately 76 ohms in free space, you slide it over to the edge where its input impedance is about 3,000 or so ohms.
Okay, so for the sake of argument, then you're saying that the radials are acting as taking up some of the wavelength, for instance. So if the vertical is a quarter wave, the radials are acting as I'm gathering by your explanation. You want an antenna that's at least a half wave, isn't that correct?
Well, I mean, it depends. You want a resonant antenna. You can do that either mechanically or electrically. And the radials don't act as a single radiating object, but as a complex combination. They offer the other end of the same radiating system. So they're part of the radiator. If you made them out of insulated material, they would be worthless. You need for them to conduct. You need to hook up one part of your coax to them. So they're part of the antenna. It's simply, unfortunately or fortunately, it's not that they're exactly the same. They operate as the same as a quarter wave piece of wire, but they're usually a lot less than a quarter wave, and also there's usually more than one. So there's usually three in space.
Well, can you measure the radials to be equivalent of the length of a quarter wave, so that coupled with the vertical, the quarter wave vertical, you would have a half wave?
Yes, you could. Well, it sort of depends what you do with the radial. If you do one single radial, then yeah, you basically have a half wave dipole where one leg is at a right angle to the other leg, with the impedance changes and the radiation distortion that all that gives. If you take three-quarter wave pieces of wire and turn it into a very a long set of radials, you have three times the amount of wire in the radials than you do in the radiator, and that's not the same physically as if you had a single wire. So the impedances change and other qualities change. Usually people have kind of done studies where they've shortened up radials to see what's the minimum length that they get approximately the same field strength. And, you know, people will write about a third of a quarter or a half of a quarter. You know, people have their own magic formulas. But you don't need to have radials that are exactly a quarter wavelength. It's a little excessive as far as radials are concerned on verticals.
Okay, that was just my input, Roy, and an adjunct question to Rich's original question. So back to you, Roy, and yeah, I guess send it back to Rich for a follow-up. Thank you for letting me get in here, W2HO.
Wesley recognized. We'll get to you soon, Wesley. Getting back to Rich, you mentioned you had the kind of impedance upside down. The nominal impedance for a quarter wave vertical with straight radials is 36 ohms. So it's not that twisting the radials down decreases the impedance of the system. It's not that it decreases the impedance, it's that it increases the impedance. You want to tweak it up from 36 ohms to 50 ohms. Now, as you put it closer to Earth ground, the impedance tends to rise anyway. So you'll see a lot of radials that are at right angles, and people can get away with that, again, because they're not using these things in outer space.
If my three radios are, let's say, 10 feet above ground, is there no ground effect at play here?
There's a little bit of ground effect. It's not a major factor, and you know, you could probably, I guess, get away with the radials being relatively straight. It's just, you know, trying to make as good a situation as possible by putting the bends in them. It makes it a little closer to that that famous one-to-one visua that everyone wants.
So in relation to what are these radios affecting or affected by, if it's in free space? Go ahead.
Well, basically just the nominal impedance of free space. It's not complicated by coupling to the Earth. As you bring an antenna out of free space into, you know, close to the surface of the Earth, you get reflections, you get coupling, you get all kinds of fun complications.
I think I got it. By the way, how is the antenna sounding tonight?
You're sounding good. There's a little bit of crackle in the back, but for all intents and purposes, very good.
Okay, I think Wesley had a comment.
Yes, indeed. Wesley, what was your comment?
I would like to play devil's advocate. There is no such thing as unbalanced antenna. Would you disagree with that?
There are better balanced antennas and far worse balanced antennas. Again, we gotta end up playing semantics. In a perfect world, you could make a case for the fact that there is no such thing as a perfectly balanced antenna either, because I guess theoretically you would have to construct a device that was identical right down to the smallest fraction of a number.
I'm going to partially repeat what you said, and I'm going to treat it as if we're talking about most of the cases. A balanced antenna is one where the elements are fed and are equal length on both sides, such a dipole antenna. Balanced antennas can be fed with open wire transmission line or with coax with balloon. One of the exceptions is OCF dipole. I'm going to get to it shortly. It is one of those antennas that has the balance fed point shifted away from the center. Just a few words about it. A dipole has a nominal impedance of 73 ohms. It can be fed with 75 ohm balance line, directly with 75 or 50 ohm coax, or with coax and one-to-one balance. But when the fit point is shifted away from the middle, the impedance value starts going up. The 14% point is somewhere between 300 and 200 ohms, which is why you will see some use of 4-to-1 balloon or 6-to-1 balloon. So let's talk right now about unbalanced antenna. The unbalanced antenna has one element being fed, such as a ground plane or coaxial cable. A HF vertical antenna using radials is definitely an unbalanced antenna and can be fed directly with coax or through the one-to-one. Many multiband vertical antennas will be fed with 4-to-1. So it helps the antenna tuner to find low impedance points over the wide frequency range. However, if you think about unbalanced antenna, the balance is counterpoise. How can you say that it's unbalanced? It's just that we use the word unbalanced. Or am I wrong? And to Ajir.
Well, Wesley, among other things, I would tend to disagree with you about a off-center fed dipole being a balanced radiator. It's not a balanced radiator. Once it's not on center, it has an imbalance to it, whether it's significant or not. And you can argue the fact that basically the current has to go in and out, so ultimately it seems balanced. But the distribution is different in off-center dipoles and ground plane vertical antennas and all kinds of things other than symmetrical half-wave dipoles that are center-fed. And, you know, like I was saying before, as far as semantics are, one could make some kind of weird argument that nature doesn't really allow for exact lengths to be reproduced, probably. So for all intents and purposes, it's very, 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 very slightly unbalanced, even a half-wave center-fed wire. But getting back to the first point, I think that the off-center-fed dipoles are also unbalanced.
Okay, so let me go to off-center. A half-way dipole is usually fed at its center because there is where maximum current occurs. Feeding the dipole at the point yields a minimum free space impedance of 70 to 72 ohms. That makes it possible to use the popular 50-ohm coaxial in with relatively low mismatch SWR levels on fundamental frequency and odd harmonics thereof. So we have a 7 megahertz half dipole, it will also work on 21 megahertz. But keep in mind that the impedance of the half-wave dipole varies with height above the ground. For example, when it is installed at the height of 0.13 of wavelength above the ground, its impedance will be closer to 50 ohm, which is perfect for 50-ohm coaxial cable. So the impedance of half-wave dipole resides as we move the feed point off the center, away from maximum RF current minimum impedance of 72 ohms, and into increasing RF voltage territory. So that's why we call it off-center feed dipole antennas, and we choose offset feed point where theoretical impedance is approximately 300 ohm on the antenna's fundamental frequency of resonance. Let me stop. They will be then able to use the 6-to-1 current balloon RF choke at the feed point, which will conveniently allow the use of the 50 ohms coax, which most of the ham radio operators like to use. So this convenient feed point impedance is located about 1/3, 32% of the dipole length away from one end. Now, do you agree with that or you disagree with that?
Well, right now you're just kind of doing a description of what these things are. They're called off-center fed dipoles because they're not on center. on center, not only is it the highest point of current, it's the lowest impedance available. If you tap a half-wave dipole at any other place, the impedance is higher than the 73 nominal ohms of impedance. And when you off-center it, it goes up. If you off-center it to the very edge, it goes up into the thousands of ohms. If you offset it to a certain degree, you can have it have an impedance of 200 or 300 or 450, and you can feed it with open line and with an impedance match, and then bring it down to 50 ohms at the source of your transmitter. So yeah, I agree. It's kind of descriptions of what it is.
Yeah, I think I should. I should formulate some sort of guiding principle that would be characteristic to OCFD. Let me put some more information in the middle before I go to that. The dipole feed point impedance will vary with its height above the ground and with dielectric constant of the ground below the antenna. The 6-to-1 balance will likely be transforming impedances lower than 300 ohms, and that takes the impedance transforming ratio to unpredictable region. So if we have that case, the current balance will only serve as RF choke, which is better than nothing, I guess. But if we have neat 6-to-1 agreement, if that neat 6-to-1 agreement falls into the pieces, we may try the same OCF antenna on another frequency band that will then the fundamental frequency will be different from which it was intended. The impedance will not be 300 ohms, and the other frequency bands, I'm not sure what I want to say here, but what I believe is guiding principle would be that if there is a RF current present on the chosen offset feed point of, say, 80 meter half wave off center feed point of OCFD, then this feed point is usable. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, but I think we're straying way far away from W2BZ's question.
Yes, because we went. What I wanted to say, saying that I'm going to play David's advocate is kind of contradict the term of unbalanced antenna, which is widely used, because there is no such thing as unbalanced. The nature is balanced. And if we're talking about phase changing in the middle of the, in the length of the coax, or in the antenna at a 1/8 of the wave or 1/4 of the wave at each end of the antennas, we may also say that we are not interested of the consequential unbalance. We are interested in the whole structure as balanced structure with the counterpoise. So the total picture, not the fractional picture, would be what is important to us. And that's why I believe the term unbalanced is just widely used for convenience, just to differ between balanced and unbalanced, but there is no such thing as unbalanced. And to agree.
Again, unfortunately, this strikes me as more an argument about semantics than of physics. Obviously, what goes in goes out, that things are electronically balanced, if you will. But that's not exactly what any of us mean when we say that an off-center fed dipole is an unbalanced radiator. As far as the geometries of the current fields, they're not symmetrical, and thus they are not they're not balanced in terms of electrical circuits. In terms of physics, of energy and such, anything that goes in has to come out. You know, charges are always conserved, but that's not what we mean or what most people I know of mean when we talk about a balanced circuit, a balanced transmission line, a balanced radiator. It's more the geometry of the current that's not symmetrical.
Yes, just to go back to the original question and finish that, because when I start to talk about halfway dipole and the parasitic capacitor, which is important, if we have two arms with one-fourth of lambda, and the total length is a quarter wave, half wave of the dipole, and then we go to magnitude of the current, corresponding position of the arms versus the RF source, is going to take too much, and it's going to just waste the time that could be used for others to formulate their own questions. I tend to disagree with you, disagreeing that this is only the semantic. And to Adrian.
AC2GS. Okay, Wesley, you are free to disagree to my disagreement of your disagreement. And then perhaps we can talk about it at some other time. I think if we go into a discussion of the matrix math of radiating antennas, we will put everyone to sleep, including probably myself, so I wouldn't hazard it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you giving me the time to respond.
You're welcome, Wesley. Rich, W2BZ, I don't know if I attempted to answer your question as far as impedance changes. Impedance changes with almost anything. Impedance changes when you take a radiating device from free space and put it closer to the surface of the Earth. It changes when you alter the geometry of the radiating element. It probably changes if you sneeze on it.
Can they be optimized to three radials by changing the angle in some way, I guess with an antenna analyzer, reading the results, or would that be fairly foolish because the change wouldn't be that great? Go ahead.
Well, I think ultimately the change wouldn't be that great. You could still sort of do it. You could probably tweak something that has a VISWA of 1.2 to 1.1. Theoretically, it also depends upon how close to ground, because as you bring a vertical closer and closer to ground, its impedance goes up as well. So you might not have to tweak the radials at all if the height above ground is not severe. In free space, 45 degrees will give you about a 50 ohm impedance for a ground plane quarter wave. But, you know, 10 feet off the ground, you could probably settle with angles that are far less than 45, 5, 10, and the difference between that is sort of immaterial. So you can do it. The benefits are not great.
Well, that's what I thought, and I'm going to keep it as is, because just bending them, you know, a new antenna, bending the radials on a new antenna gives me the willies, and who knows if one snaps off and yada, yada, yada. So I'll leave it the way they're bent, which is, I guess, 45 degrees, and hope for the best. Thanks, Roy. I do understand your explanation.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Rich, for the question. Craig, KD2OGB, I think you had a question tonight?
Yes, and it's actually something that that actually would give me a little help because I was considering parting ways with it, but maybe I might hold on to it a little longer. KD2OGB, first, how mechanically knowledgeable are you with DSLRs?
Not a great deal. I have a digital single lens reflex. I've moved on to a mirrorless camera in the last year. I know the underpinnings of it. I've never repaired one.
Perhaps in the future I'm going to pick up an SL1 and a 5DS or a 5DSR. So the last time I used my Rebel T5, which I'm looking at on the floor in front of me here, I looked at the lens, that looked fine. I looked at the mirror, that was fine. But then I realized, oh, I could just go into the settings to make it open or shut so I can get to the sensor. But there's all these pixels that I'm seeing in the photo, and the lens is fine and the mirror is fine. I assume it has to do with the sensor, correct?
Yeah, the mirror is simply there for you to look at through the lens. It's not part of the camera's picture-taking ability, so it has no effect. So if there is some distortion in the images that are recorded, it's a problem with the sensor. Let me ask you a relatively simple question. Have you considered cleaning the sensor?
Yes, I have, and that would actually allow me to keep it perhaps a little longer, but I've held it for like 5 years. But I could hold on to it a little longer. What would be the best tool to clean the sensor since it's really hard to reach down there?
There are actually products available on Amazon. I don't recall them offhand. I own one. They're in a little box, and they give you a applicator and instructions and the proper fluid, and it's relatively pain-free. If you want, I can look it up after the net or towards the end of the net, and I can email you the exact item that I purchased. But you could do a search on Google and find a number of mirror cleaners for cameras. They're pretty much the same whether they're mirror cameras or non-mirror cameras. The only difference is you have to obviously move the mirror away to get at the sensor.
Yeah. Little particles were in the shot, and a friend of mine looked at it, and he told me it's probably your sensor. So you either need to get it professionally cleaned, or you can buy the stuff with not that much money to do it yourself. It's pretty much very easy to do.
Intuition.
Yes, Wes recognized. Yeah, Craig, again, if you've got the scratch and the inclination, you can have a professional do a beautiful professional job. If it's an old camera that you're not quite sure whether you should invest too much in, the over-the-counter products that are available via, you know, B&H Photo or Amazon pretty much work for most people. The problem is that sensors do get dust and such on them. And there are different ways of recording the amount of dust. But the only way, you know, depending upon the camera, some of them have a vibrate mode where they shake some of the dust off, but that's usually not as good as just cleaning the sensor completely. But Wesley has something to say on the subject?
Yeah, I mean, I have some information about the nature of the dust that actually is to how to do, remove it. Well, every time you swap lenses, you effectively inviting particles of dust to swirl right on the stick, so that would create an electrostatic charge. The internal camera carries the mirror, which is the body chamber, and the camera sensor. So while it is less ideal to have a dust anywhere inside the body on the camera. The only time it becomes real nuisance is when it clings to the sensor and appears on your photos. So if you use just, I don't know the English word for it, but you can buy in Radite or in any other store the tip sticks, which is a piece